Welcome to the CDH Conversations podcast. My name is Jean Ewang, a counsel in the CDH Employment Law Department. Joining me today in conversation is Pitani Nkuna, a director in the Employment Law Department, as well as Tato Marapula, an associate in the Employment Law Department. South Africa has a very rich multicultural society with 12 official languages, including South African Sign Language, which has formally been recognized as an official language. Furthermore, we have a variety of ethnicities and races, which trace their roots back to various origins. It is therefore unsurprising that South Africa's workforce is quite diverse. And whilst the diversity is a strength, it can also at times lead to a source of conflict. The focus of today's panel will be understanding and managing multi-generational, multicultural workplaces with the added dimension of differences in gender. We'll be exploring three themes. Firstly, generational differences. Secondly, cultural differences. And lastly, gender differences. Pitani, I'd like to start with you. What are some of the challenges that arise from a multi-generational workplace?
Before we get to the challenges, I'd like us to start with a bit of definitions. We live in very interesting times. For the first time, we have about five generations in the workforce. They are the traditionalists born between 1925 and 1945. These make up about 2% of the workforce. Then we have baby boomers, people born between 1946 to 1964. They comprise 25% of the workforce. We have Generation X, people born between 1965 and 1980, 35% of the working population, and Millennials or Gen Y, people born between 1981 and 2000, they make up the majority of the workforce at 35%. And finally, Gen Zs, born between 2001 and 2020, they make up 5% of the workforce. So you can appreciate what this mix brings into the workplace. Research, as well as our own lived experiences, have demonstrated challenges in communication, productivity, levels of engagement, teamwork, as well as retention. Some examples that I'd like to articulate include differences in preferred modes of communication. Older generations, these would be the Gen X and older, they tend to prefer face-to-face communications or formal discussions, while the younger generations, Gen Y and younger, would prefer communications or instructions that are written down or sent via email. A bit informal, they like that level of flexibility. There's also a difference in the way the colleagues communicate between the various generations. The younger generation, for example, being prone to saying, hey, as opposed to the traditional greetings of dear Miss X. These days, we've also seen Outlook coming to the party, introducing reactions to emails. So as opposed to the traditional, I acknowledge receipt or I have noted your email, you could simply punch in or select a reaction, thumbs up. That is acknowledging. We have technology. Traditionalists and baby boomers still believe in face-to-face meetings, phone calls, you know, the typical structure that was quite prevalent during an early mid-20th century. Gen X prefers a blend. They're traditional, but also prefer digital communication. They are mostly known as the bridge between the young and old, especially because they were the early adopters of mobile technology and other fancy tools. Then we have the millennials, born into technology during the rise of the digital age. They like instant, newer tech, flexibility. You know, we're often referred to as the microwave generation. Interestingly, they were also found to value diversity, equity, and inclusion, and generally value life experiences and purpose. Then we have Gen Z. Now, these I call the amplified version of millennials. Multicultural mindset. You know, they can have their hands in different things, but they also prefer a personal touch, one-on-one approach. They prefer direct, in-person, honest, straightforward, and transparent communication. It doesn't cut it to send them feedback on email. They still want that engagement. They want to question things. They want to understand. You know, they need a coach, not a boss. Then we've also seen social media coming to the party. The younger generation wants to tweet about everything. They are on Instagram. They are on TikTok. They are on X. For example, hashtag a day in the life of an attorney, you know, the spotter of the day, waking up, getting into the job. And this is not without risks, you know, ranging from actual business operational risk, breach of confidentiality, and even putting their very jobs in jeopardy, you know, by filming or recording everything and publicizing it, you could bring the employer into disrepute. You could breach confidentiality in a matter that you're working on. So the challenges are quite widespread.
Thanks, Bettini. And something that you've just touched on in relation to social media, I think is quite critical and important, because I think we all quite enjoy some of these day in the life of videos. But Tato, I want to direct something to you on that score, because whilst these day in the lives and social media recordings can be quite innocuous, oftentimes they might be impacting the workplace, as Bettini has pointed out. So from your perspective, and with the prevalence of social media in the workplace and with our younger colleagues or colleagues across the spectrum, what are some of the practical tools that are available to an employer when an employee is posting on social media and it impacts the workplace?
So ordinarily, what an employee does outside of working hours is of no consequence to the employment relationship. Now, having said that, a number of judgments have recognized the concept of duty misconduct and held that in certain circumstances of duty misconduct may result in disciplinary proceedings against the employee, notwithstanding the fact that misconduct occurred outside of the employee's normal working hours or during their personal time. Now, the test is that there must be a nexus or a link between the conduct which is complained of and the employee's duties, the employer's business or the workplace, and that the employer must have a sufficient and legitimate interest in the conduct or activities of the employee outside of the working hours or outside of the workplace. And I'll put differently, what you post online in your personal capacity and during your personal time may result in disciplinary proceedings against you if what you post brings the employer's good name into disrepute.
Thanks, Tato. And I think with that outline and some key considerations, I want to pose a question to both of you in relation to what are some of the practical insights or practical steps that an employer can implement to address or to accommodate some of these generational challenges that we have just addressed. Let's start with you, Bettini.
I would say be intentional about diversity and inclusivity. What practices do you have in place to foster integration? Because it really is about integrating the various generations you have in your workplace. Some examples include flexible work arrangements, including remote working options. Obviously, these depend on the type of operation you run. For some businesses, this may not be feasible. But as an employer, it does serve your workforce to address work-life integration. I don't believe we can ever really find a balance, but at some point we need to integrate, accommodating different work preferences and life stages of employees. For example, a young father needing to drop off his child at school before work, you know, things like that, accommodating those life requirements or stages enhance motivation and engagement and, in fact, retention. The physical design of the workspace also makes a difference. Have a mix of workspaces, you know, just to accommodate the different physical work environment preferences, you could make room for that. Secondly, personalized development opportunities. Each generation, and in fact, each employee presents with different needs. As an employer, you can't have a universal approach to development. You definitely need variety, which takes into cognizance the difference between the generations and people. Leveraging technology technology. Otherwise, you fall behind from a competitive edge and key talent retention and acquisition perspective. Employers should also be mindful that there may be a gap for some generations. You need to fill the gap by providing training and support for employees who are less comfortable with new tech and platforms that you bring into the workplace. Leadership training, this cuts both ways. The younger and older generations both require skills and knowledge to help them lead and navigate the diversely constituted teams, to understand each generation's unique attributes and challenges, and to learn a productive way of engaging. Some of these could focus specifically on empathy, EQ, active listening, effective and constructive feedback. Regular feedback, your surveys, focus group sessions, and something that is not new to South Africa, open forums that has representativity across the different generations. This helps you capture the different opinions in your workspaces, as well as preferences, understanding what needs are in your organization, and helps you devise relevant response strategies. In fact, being proactive in doing so and not waiting for problems to show themselves. And I would say, finally, develop clear policies and guidelines which address topical issues such as use of social media, what you can and cannot do, how you use your company equipment. If you have a cell phone, a laptop, what are the parameters for use? It's important to have those clear guidelines in place and parameters, but to also be inclusive in the type of language that you use in your policies.
Thank you, Pateni. Tato?
Thank you, Jean. Pateni mentioned quite a number of strategies that an employer can also implement. And from my side, I would say that coming back to the point of developing and formulating clear policies, that will be important, as well as providing training on those policies so that there's no misalignment with regards to what the expectations are. And over and above that, I would also recommend that employers consider cross-generational mentorships in order to facilitate the sharing and the transfer of knowledge amongst the different generations.
Thank you both. I do believe that a multi-generational workplace is something to be celebrated and to be encouraged. Over the last years, and just picking up on something that you mentioned, Pateni, work-life balance, and particularly in the past few years, particularly with our younger generations in the workplace, that is something that has become quite topical and quite important and speaks to retention and avoiding burnout. Currently in South Africa, what is the law's position on work-life balance, or in particular, the right to disconnect?
These are such interesting topics. The right to disconnect first showed itself in 2001 from a French Supreme Court decision, and it went on to solidify over the years. We've seen this locally within the continent as well as internationally. I mean, in East Africa, there were even proposals around compelling employers to establish policies which outline circumstances under which an employer may contact an employee outside of working hours, regulating the use of electronic devices for work-related communication, and specifying conditions under which the right to disconnect may be waived. And it also went on to define the nature of compensation for employees who work outside of South Africa. Some countries recognize the right to disconnect in response to the always-on culture, which was at its peak during an immediately post-COVID-19, and we've seen technology as well evolving. I mean, Outlook prompts you to send an email at 8 a.m. if you're typing and want to send it after hours. You can, in fact, schedule emails to go off at a specific time. Now, specific to South Africa, we don't have a piece of legislation that specifically deals with the right to disconnect. I mean, even the Basic Conditions of Employment Act's Code of Good Practice on the Arrangement of Working Time doesn't deal with the issue. The closest we've seen is the Basic Conditions of Employment Act's overtime provisions. However, these exclude senior managerial employees, employees who work offsite and are actually sales employees, those who work less than 24 hours a month for a particular employer, and those who get paid above the earnings threshold. There's also a further exclusion which deals with work which is required to be done without delay owing to circumstances for which the employer could not reasonably have been expected to make provision and which cannot be performed during ordinary hours of work. That being said, we've seen over the years through our jurisprudence that an employer has some level of prerogative to expect flexibility. I mean, specific to your job description, some contracts build in a provision that says that you may be required over and above what your JD stipulates to perform additional and reasonable tasks. So there are instances which are permissible in law, especially where something could go wrong if you don't action an instruction. You know, there are serious repercussions. In those instances, you might find yourself going through a disciplinary inquiry if you don't execute an instruction. The lawfulness and reasonableness of that instruction is something that is subject to debate. But what I would say is employers, to the extent that depending on the nature of the operation, they may require you to action stuff outside of ordinary working hours, you need to regulate that in your employment agreements.
Thank you, Pitseni. I think wrapping up on the issue of generational differences, these are very important issues that employers need to be mindful of. I'd like us then to move on to cultural differences in the workplace and practical ways in which to foster a more inclusive workplace. As I've been mentioning throughout this podcast, South Africa has a very rich multicultural society, and that is mirrored in our workplaces. And of course, this is wonderful, but can be a source of friction. Pitseni, can you just speak to us about how employers can understand these cultural differences, foster inclusivity, and manage some of the cultural differences in the workplace?
There are quite a number of very useful mechanisms that have been proposed, and some have been put in place and have shown positive results. I mean, some of the practical things that you could do, especially because understanding and managing these differences is crucial for building cohesive and high-performing teams, you could have culture awareness programs that look at understanding ethnicity, but also embedding your very organizational culture and values. You could have inclusivity programs, which should have at their core the corporate culture and be aimed at understanding diverse norms and perspective. You also should be inclusive in, for example, your events involve employees with different cultural backgrounds. You could have inclusive policies and practices which respect cultural nuances, regional regulations. This is particularly important for employers or organizations that have operations across different jurisdictions. You need to be cognizant of the regional regulations and differences, and this helps you operationalize inclusion. What are the geographical and cultural differences and beliefs that you need to understand or model? In fact, this could even be a success factor for your very business operations because you understand how people across different cultures and regions receive and consume whatever it is that you're bringing, whether it's a product or professional services. You could have universal standards in your policies for collaboration, communication, ethics, feedback, as well as performance management. You know, these can be reasonably adapted to ensure that your employees remain connected. What has predominantly been referred to as the global strategy. Whilst you have standard and common values, but they shouldn't be inflexible. I mean, we could talk about Ubuntu, which is a classic example of a universal standard that applies across different cultures and beliefs. Effective communication as well, very important. Ensure that you communicate with your workforce with clarity and inclusivity. You know, language and messaging is very important. You need to be intentional about connection in how you communicate. And finally, immersing yourself. You know, you cannot regulate or manage what you do not understand or know. You need to get in there and study how people think, how people relate, the various nuances across different cultures. That will help you connect better with your employees.
Thanks, Pateni. Tato, Pateni has given us some very good practical examples, but of course, as business partners to our HR practitioners, could you just take us through what is the legal framework that exists to support cultural inclusivity in the workplace?
One cannot speak about cultural differences in the workplace without mentioning legislation such as the Employment Equity Act. And in particular, the preamble of the Employment Equity Act goes as far as saying that the Act was enacted to address and eliminate unfair discrimination in employment, to ensure the implementation of employment equity, to redress the effects of discrimination, and promote economic development and efficiency in the workplace. Now, the following sections are noteworthy for employers. Namely, Section 5 of the Employment Equity Act, which deals with the elimination of unfair discrimination. Section 6, which contains a prohibition of unfair discrimination, whether directly or indirectly, on listed grounds such as race, gender, pregnancy, marital status, and the like. And it is important to note that harassment, which includes sexual harassment, is listed as a form of unfair discrimination. And then Chapter 3, which is Sections 12 to 27, deal with affirmative action and the development of employment equity plans and employment equity reports. And then lastly, Section 60, which pertains to the vicarious liability of employers. In addition to the Employment Equity Act, the LRA, or the Labor Relations Act, is also relevant as it prohibits employees from being subjected to unfair labor practices and automatically unfair dismissals. An example of an automatically unfair dismissal would be dismissing somebody for a reason related to pregnancy or any other arbitrary ground, which is listed in Section 6 of the Employment Equity Act, such as race, gender, color, age, or religion, amongst other grounds.
Are you able to highlight to us perhaps any interesting judgments that would help to guide employers when addressing cultural differences in the workplace?
Yes, there are a number of judgments where our courts have considered whether an employee has been subjected to unfair discrimination. I'll mention two for the purpose of the podcast. The first one is Solidarity on behalf of Kellerman v. Western Cape Education Department and others, wherein the employee, who was a white male, was accused of being a racist by one of his subordinates, who was a colored female. The employer convened a disciplinary hearing to determine the veracity of these allegations of racism, and an independent chairperson found that there's no merit to the allegations. The employee, namely the white male, was, however, dissatisfied with the employer's conduct and referred a dispute in terms of Section 6 of the Employment Equity Act on the basis that the false allegations of racism constituted harassment. The important principle from the Labour Court in this matter is that the Labour Court ultimately held that the employee did not plead discrimination on a listed ground, in other words, race and gender, and further failed to sufficiently plead how the conduct, namely the accusations of racism, impacted his personal characteristics or attributes and thus impugned his right to dignity. Ultimately, the court granted absolution from the instance, which means that the employee, on his own version, failed to produce sufficient evidence to reasonably establish a prima facie case of discrimination in the form of harassment on an unlisted ground. The second case is the Pariachi v. Gauteng Department of Education matter. In that case, the employee was a social worker of Indian descent, and she was placed at a school which had predominantly black learners. The employee was informed by the employer that it sought to appoint an auxiliary social worker to assist the employee in overcoming cultural and language barriers, as the employee allegedly did not understand the children and their culture. The employee accused the employer of behaving in a discriminatory manner based on race, ethnicity, culture, and language, and after sending a number of letters of demands to the employer, the employee ultimately referred a dispute to the Labour Court in terms of Section 10 of the Employment Equity Act. The Labour Court ultimately found that the employee had proved that she had been unfairly discriminated against, as the employer's conduct had the effect of humiliating and undermining the employee's dignity. The labor court further held that the employee was subjected to unfair discrimination on listed grounds, namely race, culture, ethnicity, and language, and ordered the employer to compensate the employee an amount of 50,000 rand. It is important to note that the employer did not file a statement of response or attend the proceedings of the labor court, and therefore did not place a version before court. There are also other cases, such as Hawkson v. Lane, which deal with the test for unfair discrimination in terms of Section 9 of the Constitution, and a number of recent judgments which deal with harassment in the workplace, including sexual harassment, in light of the Code of Good Practice, Prevention and Elimination of Harassment in the Workplace.
Thank you, Tato, for that insight. I think in wrapping up cultural differences, I'd like to move on to gender differences in the workplace and with some practical insights on how these can be addressed. The recent Constitutional Court judgment of Van Wyk has introduced an impactful change on how we have to administer maternity leave, adoption leave, and parental leave in general. And what's interesting about this judgment is that the Constitutional Court addressed the issue of parental leave by understanding that the distinction between men and women in relation to nurturing of children in the old leave dispensation was unfair and discriminatory because child nurturing should not or could not be restricted to a specific gender, with the women traditionally being held as the parent who was supposed to be the nurturer. And I thought this case was a good reminder in that it shows how the law evolved to meet society's needs. One of the things that has become necessary to consider and to address in our workplaces is that issue of gender differences, particularly when we refer to things such as misgendering in our colleagues or the improper use of pronouns. South Africa recognizes a binary sex system, i.e. male or female, on our official documentation, such as our ID cards and passports. There is the alteration of sex description and sex status. It's a 2003 legislation which was enacted to allow individuals whose sexual characteristics have been altered through medical treatment or natural developments to apply for a change in their sex description on their birth register. This act aims to recognize and support the rights of transgender and intersex individuals in South Africa. So whilst the current legal framework allows transgender and intersex individuals to change their legal sex marker to either male or female on official documentation, it doesn't currently provide for the recognition of a non-binary gender. These are sensitive issues in the workplace and new territories for a lot of us. Pitini, if you could maybe just highlight to us some of the things that employers should be mindful of when it comes to gender, as well as topics such as how we address or deal with non-binary individuals and our transgender colleagues.
So the hallmark from a South African perspective, at least, is our constitutional provision on equality, the right to equality, which has further translated into the plethora of non-discrimination provisions that are in the Employment Equity Act, as well as PAPUDA, and all the way to the LRA, as Tato has previously outlined. That is really the hallmark of what it is that we're dealing with, or what the obligations of employers are in South Africa, not to discriminate on the basis of gender or sexual orientation. You've spoken about the Alteration of Sex Description Act. We also have the Civil Union Act of 2006, which allows for people, two people, regardless of their gender or sexual orientation, to enter into a civil marriage or civil partnership with the same rights and responsibilities as couples in heterosexual marriages. This is at a time where there is difference across the continent on same-sex relationships or LGBTQIA plus employees. I will not get into that from a continental perspective. However, it is important for employers to be mindful of what the Civil Union Act provides for and our anti-discrimination laws insofar as the workplace is concerned. Differences in gender are a hotly contested topic. We're seeing that coming out from our courts. And very soon, I anticipate employers will be grappling with, for example, where and how to account for transgender or non-binary employees for purposes of employment equity planning and reporting, whether it is an obligation to have non-binary toilets in your physical workplace, whether it is mandatory to have diversity, equity, and inclusion policies in place, which cover not just transgender or non-binary identification, but the use of pronouns in your working environment, whether it's internally or when you communicate with external people, and what non-compliance looks like. We're currently outside of the no discrimination provisions in the various pieces of statutes that are referred to. We have no clear framework which addresses some of those very hotly contested or very topical issues. But employers, again, I iterate, will soon be finding themselves with real compliance questions that they need to answer. And when you talk about employer practices, for example, how you recruit, when an employee is about to undergo gender reassignment or change, what are an employee's obligations? Our courts have held, I mean, as far back as in 2010, our labor court confirmed that there's no legal duty on an applicant for employment to inform you as an employer that they're about to undergo gender reassignment. However, it would have been different if the candidate had been asked the question and they either lied or misrepresented, you know, that calls for a different process. However, the jury is still out on whether or not you can even ask the question as an employer. And if you can, what to make of the response if an employee says yes. So we both see quite a lot of debate, quite a lot of jurisprudence coming out on some of these things in the near future. It's interesting times.
Definitely interesting times, Bettini. And I think with the legal framework in place and with the law evolving to meet our needs as a society, we'll be looking forward to grappling with some of these topics. Just to round off on this point, Tato, perhaps because I've been pointing to you to take us through all the kind of legal frameworks, is there anything else that you think that we should be mindful of when we deal with these issues that we're talking about?
In addition to the Employment Equity Act that we've been discussing, it's also important to note that the Code of Good Practice dismissal expressly references mutual respect as a key principle, and mutual respect will be an important consideration when policies are formulated to ensure that employers create a safe working environment that is free from all forms of harassment as well as discrimination, whether on listed or unlisted grounds.
Thank you. Definitely an interesting topic. Thanks to both of you for participating in the panel. And this brings us to an end. And we look forward to further discussions on this as the law evolves. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean.
Thank you, everyone.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.